All right, we are at week 12. We got miles to go, but we're well into this series, and we're into a part of the series where we're now beginning to kind of look at specific forms of science and ways that we understand the world today. So tonight we're going to take a look at Einstein, several of his papers, one of which is on relativity, specific relativity, and then talk about this new worldview. So just, I always like to go back to the beginning, to the big picture. You're looking here at CERN, to the Large Hadron Collider, as they were doing some work on it. Our goal in this part of the series, we've done the sort of historical survey, and now we're more in the kind of the relatively contemporary world, but our goal is for this part of the series is simply to get a better grasp of how we understand creation, the creation that God has given us, through the book of modern science, borrowing there the metaphor from St. Augustine that science and faith are two different books, same origin, God being the ultimate source of both. We're not going to cover all the various fields of science. I mean, we could stay here for a couple of years probably and not exhaust them. There are just so many. It's so diversified these days. But we are picking a few to intersect with the book of faith. So the book of science, the book of faith, following as our Methodist system says that these are complementary, not contradictory. So in this section of our longer series, we began last week with geology and paleontology, and this idea of deep time, or sometimes called deep history. Just a quick synopsis of that before we move on. Period from 1780 to 1860 is known as the geological revolution. Here on the right, you can see sort of a graph of that, of the various kind of times. We've been able to flesh that out in great detail at this point. That revolution, scholars say, was analogous to the Copernican Revolution. The Copernican Revolution dealt with the immensity of space and our place within it. Now, Copernicus did not know that there was more than just our solar system and the stars around it. We now know that it's even more immense. But by shifting the Earth to the center, or the sun to the center, and seeing our place within that, that did give us a better sense of kind of where we were in this broader picture. The geological revolution dealt with the immensity of time and our place within it. So Copernican is space, geology is time. Today, we're going to turn to yet another revolution. We've got several revolutions that are coming in the next few weeks. This is the one, though, that's given credit for laying the foundations for how we understand the universe today. And actually, the next 3 weeks are going to be mining Einstein for insights. Today we'll do relativity. Next week we'll be doing cosmology, Big Bang, the principle that the universe has order, and then we'll hit on quantum physics. This is a revolution that is attributed broadly to one man. Now we're going to see tonight another guy that was actually working on relativity prior to Einstein. So, and again, no scientist ever stands alone. They stand on the back and shoulders of other people, but he gets the credit for actually getting this out there. And that, of course, would be Albert Einstein. And it's a revolution that can be summarized in one word, which is to say relativity. That becomes sort of the banner around which these ideas are formed. The cover of the October 5th, 2012 issue of the New Scientist magazine had a very interesting title. And it raised what it called the ultimate question, which is to say, what is real? What is the larger reality that you and I are a part of? Now, answering that question is essentially the task that science has been pursuing for centuries. We're trying to understand that book of creation, the larger thing that we are all a part of. In the past century, what we've seen, though, is a fundamental shift in how we answer that question. There was a shift with the rise of modern science in the 1500s, 1600s, and then 1700s, sort of ending up with Isaac Newton and the Principia Mathematica. That was a paradigm shift there. We see the same thing happening at the turn of the 20th century. The modern view of reality that came at the age of Newton. So we now have this radical new view that's replaced the view that we had. So here's a classic picture you can see of the new view with time and space being warped by gravity. We'll be getting to that in a little bit. But before we look at our world and how our worldview has been fundamentally altered by Einstein's work, but it might be helpful to take about 5 minutes and just remind ourselves, what was it like on the stage that Einstein stepped onto? What was the modern scientific, or sometimes called the Newtonian worldview? What was that exactly? I want to lift up some specific things that are relevant for us. The Newtonian worldview was a mathematical understanding of the basic laws, and that's the key word, laws of the universe. This view had several distinctive aspects. I'm simply going to lift up four. And these four things shaped how we viewed what is real or what is even possible. And some people in our society still operate out of this mind view in terms of what is real, what is possible. Four key factors in the Newtonian worldview relevant for our topic I like to lift up. First is this: Newtonian physics and the resulting modern scientific worldview are essentially dualistic. And that term has a specific meaning. Dualistic in this sense: the rise of modern science made a distinction between what is natural or empirical or material and what isn't. Newtonian mechanics explained the material universe, the stuff of the natural world. It did so without reference, and this was new, without reference to any non-empirical influences or causes. Now, this was essentially a methodological decision. It was a decision about how to proceed with science. We were to look for natural or empirical explanations for natural phenomena. So you, as you examine nature, as you look at nature, you're looking for natural explanations for what's going on. Now, this resulted in the universe being seen as a closed system. It's a system that was understood to have no beginning and no end. Now we have a little bit different understanding today with the Big Bang and stuff, but essentially this was a timeless system, always was, always will be. There also was no beyond or no outside. So there was no transcendent or metaphysical or supernatural. Although ironically, this language emerges as a part of the new scientific worldview. The universe was viewed as self-contained, self-explained, all-inclusive of reality. You did not need God or any other non-natural, non-empirical way to explain the universe. You looked for the answers internally. Everything could be explained within the system mathematically and mechanically for Newton. Now, when this way of viewing reality first came in, it was a radical departure from what we had seen before in the Middle Ages or in the ancient world. Prior to Newton, prior to the rise of modern science, the material and the spiritual were seen as commingled. God was seen as a part of the world and as active within the world. Of course, this would be the biblical view. And God was seen as the cause and the explanation for all natural phenomena, true both in the biblical tradition and in philosophers like Aristotle and Plato and others. Therefore, prior to the modern world, you did not need any language of trans, meta, or super, because it was all-inclusive. So prior to the modern world, terms like these simply were not needed, since everything was viewed as interconnected, or sometimes you hear the word kind of organic. God and the spiritual were simply seen as part of the natural world. It's probably the mindset many of us were raised with. The language of trans, meta, and super emerged as a byproduct of the Newtonian worldview and its dualistic partitioning. So we're going to explain everything materially. And then if you're going to talk about some stuff that does not fall within that category, you have to find alternative language. And that's what it was. It divided, of course, the world in what was natural, what was not. Second characteristic is the Newtonian worldview was materialistic. Reality was constituted by the physical, the material, the empirical. Now, energy would be included in the physical as is within that. So matter and energy. There was no non-material or spiritual reality, at least not in the sense relevant for science. That's not something that science went after. Now, on this issue, we need to make a little sidebar here for just a minute or so. This was an issue that really divided the scientific community, and of course, it still does divide the scientific community. We have some people saying that science was simply not concerned with what is non-empirical. This is a methodological decision, but that it holds no opinion as to whether the non-material actually exists. And this is simply known technically as methodological naturalism, that science simply doesn't care about and is not interested in what lies beyond the empirical. The empirical, this is the language, is the domain of science. Whatever falls outside that is not the domain of science. Others would argue that the empirical was all that existed. This is going a step further. This is a view that's known today as ontological naturalism. It's not just that science doesn't care about what is non-physical. This goes a step further and argues, well, if we can't measure it empirically, then it simply does not exist. This divide between those who deny the reality of the non-empirical and those who don't, and this is important, is a philosophical decision, not a scientific decision. This is not based on anything empirical. It is just given the philosophy or the worldview of that particular scientist. Third, the Newtonian worldview is deterministic. The natural and the material could be explained by cause and effect, by predictable laws. So therefore, with Newton, you have the three laws of motion and the law of gravity. And the Principia, the laws of motion take what, two pages, and the law of gravity takes the rest of the book. These laws were seen in the Newtonian world as immutable, meaning that they were believed to be the same everywhere. These laws did not vary. Or if you're going to use Einstein language, they were not relative. They were absolute. All situations, all circumstances, these laws were believed to be the same, whether you were on the earth, or whether you were in space, or whether you were under a microscope, whatever it was. The basic idea is that cause and effect could explain everything. This meant that no explanation of another explanation was needed, such as God. Some atheistic people have said, you know, that God is not a hypothesis that they need. It fits with this understanding. The deterministic worldview later spilled over into, first it started with the hard sciences, but later it flows into such things as biology, and then you'll see even in sociology and some other places. In a deterministic worldview, there is no place for free will, and there's no purposeful action. Fourth, the Newtonian worldview was mechanistic. The universe was viewed as a machine, which led in the 1700s to the famous clock metaphor, that the universe is kind of like a clock with gears. And then in this view, the universe was impersonal, cold, uncaring. It was just a vast machine that the gears kept turning. By the way, that is again a very different view from prior to modern science in the Middle Ages of the ancient world. Now it's this view, this mechanistic view, that would dominate science and Western culture for nearly 400 years. And this was the dominant worldview at the beginning of the 20th century, which is where our story is going to start in just a moment. It is this mechanistic worldview that produced the conflict metaphor in the late 1800s. There simply was no room for God in this model, as well as the idea that science and faith are incompatible, because if science can explain everything with cause and effect, then if you're going to come in with some other, quote, hypothesis or way of explaining things, that would be seen as a violation. Now, to Albert Einstein. In 1905, this is the stage that Albert Einstein is going to step into, but we have to add a little bit more nuance here. At the turn of the century, it was already known that the Newtonian worldview, which had served us remarkably well for centuries and had produced the wonders of the scientific world and the technology even of the 19th century, it was widely known that this was no longer adequately explaining, Newton's understanding was no longer adequately explaining what we were learning about the universe. The problem was that there were places where the Newtonian worldview, the quote, modern scientific worldview, fell apart. Something did not work. This was well known within the scientific community. You're looking at one of the examples. According to Newton, all lines of force were straight lines. Clearly, he was wrong. And this is not the only example. Another problem people were aware of was the orbit of Mercury. The problem was that Mercury's orbit progressed. Now, all orbits are ellipses, not circles. But instead of going in an ellipse, kind of the same track over and over, what astronomers notice is that the orbit, the technical term is progressed, but slowly it makes kind of a daisy chain going around. Now, according to Newton's laws, this could not happen, or at least could not be explained. But it was happening. That is a problem. Another area that was problematic arose when we looked at things that were very small, like atoms. Now, atoms, the idea has been around since the 4th century BC, 5th century BC, with the atomists, but in terms of actually being able to prove it, it was at this point still sort of very controversial. Actually, this is an issue that Einstein will resolve for us. But when you look at atoms and the phenomenon there, the question that was raised is, why are atoms stable? Now, according to Newtonian physics, they shouldn't be. According to Newton's laws of motion, electrons should lose energy, should slow down, the atom fall apart, but obviously they didn't. That was another problem. As a worldview and as an all-inclusive way of understanding the nature of reality, one that could account for all these, quote, problems, the modern worldview, the Newtonian worldview, was viewed by the science community at the dawn of the 20th century widely as no longer adequate. We needed a new way of understanding the universe. This is where science stood at the dawn of the 20th century. Again, this is the stage that Albert Einstein is going to step onto. But I want to introduce you to a character that you may or may not know, because he's remarkable. In 1905, Albert Einstein, an unknown clerk working in a patent office, read a book by a French mathematician named Henri Poincaré. The book is called The Value of Science. Now, Poincaré was a savant. He was practically in every field of science, physics, cosmology, you name it. He's considered to be the last person who really knew everything. This book that he wrote, that at the time was cutting edge science, was exploring the relationship between the two pillars that modern science stood on: mathematics and empirical experimentation. We looked at this earlier. There is empirical science through experimentation, and then there is mathematic science using pure thought. Modern science stands on these two foundations. Poincaré observed that the two legs of science, math and empirical experiments, were creating problems for each other at the turn of the 20th century. The core problem for Poincaré was the discovery of experimental facts, which, you know, we looked at James Clerk Maxwell and you know, electromagnetism and others. It's just, you know, the late 1800s, the discoveries are coming fast and furious all over the place. So what was happening is, out of the lab are coming empirical results that seem to violate the mathematical laws by which the universe was understood. And again, most of those laws had been laid down first by Isaac Newton, and then of course by James Clerk Maxwell. Specifically, Poincaré identified four problems that had arisen that needed to be solved in physics. This is 1905. He referred to these as clouds on an otherwise sunny scientific mastery of the universe. By the early 1900s, science had done so much, answered so many questions, but there were just a few things out there that were sort of uncertain. The first one he mentioned was the problem of the photoelectric effect, which has to do with explaining how light, or photons, knocked electrons off the surface of metal. And then that, of course, would produce then various kinds of light and energy, and then you have certain results of that. Now, the spectra, now this is before spectra gas, but you would see this in the form of light and colors of light. So the spectra that this produced indicated that only certain levels of energy were being released, not the full spectrum as expected. Now, today with spectrography, we know exactly why that is. But in early 1900s, it was a puzzle that needed to be resolved. Why did the light only come out at certain energy levels? Why not all? Why were there gaps in the spectra? As he's writing the book, no one knows the answer to this. And the answer, when it comes, will be breathtaking. Second, how do you explain why pollen particles suspended in water, move in the, you know, with no outside energy being put into it, so it should be perfectly still, yet when you look under a microscope, the pollen particles are moving around in a random zigzag pattern. Now, this is something known as Brownian motion. Third, Newton's third law of motion, that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction, seemed to be in conflict with the laws of electrodynamics that had been proposed by James Clerk Maxwell, such as magnetic and electric forces not existing in straight lines. Newton says they should. Maxwell showed that they didn't. Fourth, the principle of the conservation of mass seems to fall apart as you approach the speed of light. I'm not sure how they were doing that in 1905, but they're aware of it and they're talking about it. This was known as the relativity issue, something that Poincaré did some pioneering work in. Some may not realize. He was working in relativity before Einstein was, but he was unable to successfully solve the problem. Now, according to Poincaré, these were four of, not the only four, but four of the major issues that lay before physics that were unresolved. Therefore, this was the task of physics for the next generation. The clouds, these were the clouds in an otherwise sunny view of how modern science had triumphantly mastered the physical world. We just got a few things we need to figure out. Now, Einstein read the book, and then he decided to attack all four of these problems in Poincaré's book. 4 months later, he had published four papers. Einstein had solved all four of these. So what I want to do now is simply to walk you through these papers. These papers would fundamentally change the way that we view the universe. This is why 1905 later becomes known as the miracle year. You can see why. The first paper was on black body radiation, which is related to the photoelectric effect. In its simplest forms, when you heat metals to different temperatures, why do they glow at different colors? It can be a dull red to a bright red, going into a white, maybe even into a blue. So why is that? Now, back in 1905, 5 years earlier, Max Planck, one of the leading physicists of the world, was also working on the problem of black body radiation. He proposed an idea, this idea of a quanta, to solve a math problem. What's interesting about this is that by quanta, Planck meant that light existed in distinct packets. It's not continuous. So it's not a wave as commonly accepted. Now, here's the caveat. Max Planck did not believe that quanta really existed. The idea was a fudge that he used to make the math work. Now, Einstein later will do a famous fudge in one of his theories. So mathematicians sometimes do this. You put something in to make the math work, not thinking it corresponds with reality. In his paper, Albert Einstein proposed that this theoretical thing, quanta, actually did exist. That light existed in distinct packets or quanta. The paper laid out the mathematics for how this worked. In so doing, Einstein is running against the grain. He's contradicting the prevailing view that light was made up of waves. This paper would lay the foundations for quantum physics. Later, several years later, after his theory was empirically verified in the lab, Albert Einstein would be awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1921 for this paper. So the miracle year is off to a good start. Einstein's second paper went after the problem of Brownian motion, or the phenomenon of Brownian motion. This motion was again first noted all the way back in 1827 by Robert Brown. We've got the optics, we've got microscopes, we can look down there. So what the heck is going on here? His paper provided the concepts and the math to explain this motion. And in doing so, this paper is credited for demonstrating the existence of atoms. The motion was being caused by individual atoms in motion colliding with the tiny pollen grains. So we have both empirical and we have a mathematical explanation for how this is happening. Now, the math used to explain Brownian motion and which can predict shifts over time has real world applications. I'm just going to give you three, okay? Fluctuations in the stock market. Algorithms that are used in the stock market are based on what is called Brownian mathematics. It's also used in medical imaging. It's also used in robotics. It goes on and on and on. So this math that Einstein pioneered actually helps to drive the world we live in today. The year is going well. Einstein's third paper was on the equivalence between mass and energy. This is the famous E equals mc squared. The equation showed that every particle possesses energy simply by existing, simply because it has mass. This energy is distinct and different from kinetic energy, which is based on motion, and chemical energy that's tied up in chemical bonds. In other words, mass was energy. That's what the equal sign says. Mass is energy. Conversely, energy is mass. This laid the foundations for the atomic bomb and nuclear energy and a lot of other things. Einstein's fourth paper was on special relativity. This paper dealt with the relationship between time and space. Specifically, it deals with motion in special or limited circumstances. He had to keep the math simple enough he could do it, and even here, he had to get some help. So he left out acceleration. So we're going to keep speeds constant because the math is simpler. It has two principles. The first is the principle of relativity itself. The second is the principle of the speed of light. These are related to each other, but they're different. The principle of relativity states that the laws of physics don't change even when objects are moving. I'm going to have a thing to look at as an example in just a second. The principle of the speed of light states that the speed of light is the same for all observers, and that according to this theory, the speed of light is not relative to the movement of the observer. In other words, the speed of light is fixed. Here's a little diagram. It's the best one I could find. This is called a relativistic train robbery. Top half. Bad guy's got the money trying to get away. Two people are trying to stop him. One, A, is riding on the train, fires a bullet at the robber, 100 miles an hour. Say that's the speed of the bullet. Two, there's a platform beside the train that's not moving. So B fires the gun, 100 miles an hour. Now the problem here is, of course, the train is moving 50 miles an hour forward. So what you have between the two is that A and the robber are moving at the same, moving the same. So that's the 50 mile an hour. Whereas the guy on the tower, the train is moving away from him at 50 miles an hour, and he fires it at 100 miles an hour. So that bullet is going only at 50 miles an hour. So the bullets do not strike at the same time. Bottom picture. Same thing, except this time we've got a flashlight and we're going to fire beams of light. Unlike the bullets that would arrive at two different times, the light remains constant. Their speeds are not adjusted. The light for A is 186,000 miles per second. The light for C, and the light for B is 186,000 miles per second. This is the relativity thing. With light, it doesn't change. Since all motion is relative to the frame of reference of the observer, whether you're on the train or off, you cannot tell who is moving and who is not. That's just one of the corollaries here. Nothing is absolute here. This is why it's called the theory of relativity. Newtonian physics says things are absolute. They simply do not change. With these four papers, Einstein fundamentally changed how we understand the universe. And it meant that the way we look at the universe for 300 years or 400 years was starting to unravel. You can see why 1905 is simply known as the miracle year. Again, not bad for a young, unknown patent clerk who suddenly became known very quickly. 10 years later, Einstein would produce the theory of general relativity. This is the one that was too complicated to tackle. And it takes him 10 years, and it takes him getting help from a lot of mathematicians because he didn't have the math chops to pull it off. He'd be the first to admit that. Now, general relativity was needed to resolve some paradoxes or some problems in special relativity. Einstein needed to take out the special out of special relativity and to factor in acceleration so that the equations worked for everything, not just in special circumstances, but worked, period. General relativity is special relativity extended to include acceleration. Einstein had already connected matter and energy, E equals mc squared. General relativity is going to connect space and time. And it will fundamentally change how we understand space and time. General relativity is also Einstein's theory of gravity, because it turns out that acceleration and gravity are not two different things. They're in fact two expressions of the same thing. Here is what Einstein referred to as his happiest thought. Walking around one day looking up, and he has this idea of an elevator, which is one of the modern deals that science has produced. This is one of his thought experiments. You're in an elevator, just look at the pictures. You're in an elevator left to right. Normal weight, it's not moving. Now, when an elevator starts to drop, you feel that lightness. And by the way, if you're standing on a scale, it actually, your weight decreases. Reverse happens if the elevator goes up, or if the cable snaps and you got several floors, you will actually experience weightlessness. This is not an experiment in the lab. This is one of the famous thought experiments that Einstein does. Again, in an elevator that's falling, gravity was neutralized by the acceleration. And that is a huge thought. You experience weightlessness. This would actually, again, show up on the scale. Now, today we know this as G-force. You can experience this, for example, if you were to go up in a fighter plane. I haven't, you probably haven't, but if you were, you can pull some G's, and that's forces of gravity. In acceleration, you can be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times your weight if you have a pressure suit. Or in a car, and you guys own Teslas or electric cars, or just a car with a big engine, and you floor it, and you get thrown back in the sea, that's G-force. Einstein realized in his thought experiment that acceleration and gravity were not two different things. They were two expressions of the same fundamental aspect of reality. Today, we can actually, because of technology, actually experience weightlessness. This young woman is having a blast along with her friends. She's actually in a big aircraft that's descending like an elevator at just the right, the right speed, so that they actually are totally weightless near the Earth. If you look over here, this is from the ISS, the International Space Station. Here, if you're in the space station, same thing. You're not falling, but you're further away from a large body like a planet, same thing. So falling and being away from gravity are exactly the same. This meant that gravity is not a force like magnetism, which is what Newton thought. Rather, gravity is a quality of matter itself. Gravity could even warp time and space itself. Time actually slows down in the presence of gravitational forces. The same thing happens when you get near the speed of light. Time dilates, so the language, or slows down. Space dilates. This is hard to wrap your mind around. The ruler shortens. Now, we can see this in what's called Einstein's twin paradox. Fortunately for us, we have a couple of identical twins who were astronauts, so we were able to test this, So this has now been empirically verified. In Einstein's twin paradox, one twin traveling in space near the speed of light, while the other twin remains on Earth, what would happen? Well, due to time dilation, the math says that the twin on Earth would age twice as fast as the twin in space. Of course, this is not just a toggle switch, this is a continuum. So we can actually, if we put one twin on the Earth and put another twin just 80 miles up in the air on the space station, and we have really good instruments, which we do, we can actually measure this. So this was done by the two twin astronauts, as well as by matched atomic clocks, one on the ISS, another here on Earth, and we know that one astronaut did age more than the other. Now, we're not near the speed of light, and we're not near a black hole, so it's not a vast amount, but it was measurable. Now, here's the paradox. The reverse should also be true in this sense. Earth is also moving through space. So why is there a difference in aging? It's not as though one astronaut was not moving and one astronaut was moving. They're both moving. So why this difference? The answer to the paradox lay in what Einstein had left out of the theory of special relativity, and that is acceleration. In space, the twin would age slower than the twin on Earth because the twin in space was accelerating. And here's the key language. You know, you just go with me on this. Relative to the twin on Earth. So it's not an absolute measurement of acceleration against some absolute standard out there. It's only being measured one twin relative to another. You know, one is traveling faster than the other. One is further away from the gravity source than the other. Same, same. It's this relative acceleration that made the difference. Or the other way is the relative distance would make the difference. This means that time itself, this is a mind blower, is always relative. It's not the same everywhere. There is no absolute time existing anywhere in the universe. Time is relative. It depends. You're measuring versus two things, and those two things determine time. There's another aspect of general relativity. Newton thought that space was just an empty container and that matter existed in it and that time passed with that. With general relativity, Einstein understood that space and time collectively form a separate thing. Einstein simply referred to it as space-time. The basic idea is simple. Space and time are not two different things. Space is a component and time is a component of a deeper reality called space-time. Space-time is the substance of the universe. If you can imagine the universe is just one gigantic glob of kind of clear jello with things, lights, and stars within it, that jello-y substance is space and time combined. Matter exists in it, energy exists in it, but the substance of space-time itself is what gives the universe its form. With gravity being a quality of matter or of mass. Now, space-time can be distorted, this substance of the universe, by gravity or by acceleration. When you see a picture like this of where space-time is warped, trying to graphically show how this is done, again, gravity or acceleration, either one can do this, because they're two expressions of the same thing. Now, what does all this mean? Well, what it means is that time and space and mass and energy, the four constitutive things of the universe, are not four different things. They're all interrelated. They are all connected. They are all relative to each other. Everything is connected. Everything is relative to everything else. Nothing stands alone. The universe is a dynamically integrated, finite whole. Finite is sort of a weird word considering how big it is. It's not just the aggregate of its parts. If you're going to look for metaphors, by the way, this is actually the structure of the universe itself. The universe is less like a clock and more like an organism. It's a metaphor, but it's an interesting one. By 1925, the Newtonian universe had been replaced by and large, at least within the scientific community, by the post-Einstein world of relativity. With Einstein and his work, one way of viewing the world literally comes to an end. The modern age comes to an end. That's why you get the language today that we're in the postmodern age. Postmodern is post-Einstein. It's the world of relativity. And the door opens to a new way of understanding the universe. In the post-Einstein world, the worldview is of mechanistic naturalism starts to come apart. And with it, the way of viewing reality that seems so problematic for our faith, the starting rebel. And this may be the most controversial thing in this presentation. The idea that a lot of the problematic stuff with science and faith emerges from a modern worldview, whereas when we move to the post-Einstein worldview, a lot of that just unravels. Reality is much more complex, more dynamic, and more organic than we had thought earlier. Einstein not only changed how we viewed the nature of reality, he also laid the foundations in these papers for what is to come. His work will also lay the foundations for quantum physics. We saw that in one of the papers. 2 weeks from today, our task will be to kind of work our way through that material. Einstein also laid the foundations for contemporary cosmology. For example, cosmic inflation, Big Bang, things like that come out of his equations. And also the idea that the universe evidences purposeful design, something that's called the anthropic principle. So it's to this we're going to turn first next week.